It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Joe Biden faces a divided Congress in his final 2 years of his term, and we get morning after analysis on his speech delivered to a joint session of Congress. Join in with your questions. What stood out to you about the State of the Union? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anthony Chergosky is here, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-La Crosse. Anthony, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. So on the domestic front, what stands out to you?
Certainly the fact that economic policy figured heavily into the early portions of Joe Biden's speech. As he began his State of the Union, he jumped right into what he views as the economic accomplishments of his administration. It was a safe bet that he would start that way, certainly coming off the better than expected jobs numbers last week, certainly putting some wind in his administration's sails. He touted the jobs numbers, he touted new businesses being started up, he touted positive economic indicators, even as inflation continues to be a problem for his administration. He noted that inflation is getting better, even if he is not happy with the pace of improvement on inflation. So clearly aware that inflation remains a political problem for him, just as it remains an economic problem for the country. But certainly, Joe Biden was more than eager to tout the economic accomplishments and the economic agenda, perhaps, Kate, previewing his reelection message as he goes into a potential 2024 bid.
We will still have to stay tuned on that. Do you think, you know, as we see inflation, you know, not seen in decades and really this administration grappling with it, how did he try to connect with Americans on pocketbook issues?
Well, he really did focus on those pocketbook issues, Kate. He talked about how, in his view, people had been forgotten, people had been left behind by the economy, they had seen jobs go overseas. So he was almost trying to make an economic style appeal that we might have heard former President Trump make, trying to make an appeal to those working class voters that had been so crucial to President Trump's success and have been such a focus of President Biden as he tries to reverse the Democratic Party's fortunes among those voters. So he talked about a lot of those key economic indicators. He also just had an overall populist message that I think is aimed at connecting with the average voter. He talked about raising taxes on billionaires and raising taxes on corporations. He talked about going further in trying to control the price of prescription drugs. So he definitely had an economic message that was pitched to the average voter, to the person who might pay casual attention to politics and is really focused on those bread and butter pocketbook issues.
Something we had our ear on early on, he struck notes of unity in his message right off the top, saying that Democrats and Republicans have worked together over the past 2 years, proving the cynics and naysayers wrong.
Yes, we disagreed plenty. And yes, there were times when Democrats went alone. But time and again, Democrats and Republicans came together.
What do you think of Biden's assessment of what bipartisanship looks like in Congress?
Well, first of all, Kate, I would note that there is something to what he's saying. There were plenty of bipartisan legislative achievements over the previous Congress. Now, the big catch is that the Democrats had the majorities in both the Senate and the House during the first 2 years of Biden's administration. We are in a completely new world now with Republicans holding a narrow majority in the House of Representatives. That was quite visible last night with Kevin McCarthy seated behind Joe Biden as the new Republican Speaker of the House. And also this remarkable give and take between Biden and the Republicans in the audience. It was a very almost raucous at times atmosphere. And so while Biden did try to encourage bipartisanship and try to tout some of the cross-party achievements of the last 2 years, there is also plenty of tension on display as we go into high stakes budget negotiations, high stakes negotiations surrounding the debt ceiling, and the potential for a real standoff between these two parties.
You heard words like liar and heckling out there. I'm going to reintroduce you a moment as we talk about the State of the Union. Anthony Chergosky here, UW La Crosse political scientist. Join in at 800-642-1234. So, Anthony, arguably, you know, the biggest legislative crisis could be the debt ceiling standoff. How did Biden address the debt ceiling and federal spending?
Well, Joe Biden challenged Republicans to come to the table with their plan. He said that if they want to negotiate over the debt ceiling, then they need to come to him with specific spending cuts, with specific things that they want to cut. And he had that unscripted engagement with Republicans over Social Security and Medicare. He talked about how some Republicans favor sunsetting Social Security and Medicare every 5 years. Now, that was pretty clearly based on a policy plan introduced by Senator Rick Scott of Florida, who is no ordinary senator. He ran the Republican Party's efforts in the 2022 midterms at getting Republicans elected to the Senate. So he's an important senator, and he had this idea that all federal legislation should sunset every 5 years. And he said that if a law is worth keeping, Congress can pass it again. Now, when Joe Biden brought that up, he was received with jeers and heckles from the Republicans. There were, in fact, pictures of Congress members shouting him down. And that wasn't the only time that he faced shouts from members of the audience. Now, Kate, a few years ago, back in 2009, when Congressman Joe Wilson of South Carolina yelled, "You lie," during a 2009 speech by President Obama, it was the story from the speech, and it was viewed as an enormous violation of the norms of civility in Congress. Now, it just seems like heckling and shouts from the audience are what we can come to expect from these speeches going forward.
Well, I want to move on to gun violence and policing. And last night, the president did receive bipartisan standing applause during his words about gun violence. He said, "It is up to us," talking about the case of Tyre Nichols, who was beaten at a traffic stop and later died.
I signed an executive order for all federal officers banning chokeholds, restricting no-knock warrants, and other key elements of the George Floyd Act. Let's commit ourselves to make the words of Tyler's mom true. Something good must come from this. Something good.
So we call on Congress to finish the job on police reform. How likely is that?
I'll believe it when I see it, Kate. There are some rumblings of bipartisan negotiations on police reform, but this is not something that really came together in the last 2 years. We'll see if things come together in the upcoming 2 years. Again, though, the realities in Washington have changed enormously with Republicans taking the majority, and we know that Biden is going to have challenges working with the Republican House majority, just as Speaker Kevin McCarthy is going to have challenges trying to corral some of the members and work with some of his members and try to keep some of his members unified. So this is going to be a very messy next 2 years, and there may be some legislative accomplishments, but I would keep expectations low and simply hope that Congress can do the bare minimum of keeping the lights on. But there still is the possibility of some bipartisan negotiations on police reform. It is fair to say, though, Kate, that while Biden did push for bipartisanship, he also talked about a number of policy ideas that are simply not going to happen under this current Congress.
Anthony, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Anthony Chergosky is an assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse. Up ahead, we continue to examine President Biden's State of the Union address, turning to global issues and foreign policy moments in the speech. Join in by calling with your reaction, your questions, observations, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get your takeaways on President Joe Biden's second State of the Union address since taking office and what you heard on the foreign policy front, on diplomatic challenges. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. Lily, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on this morning.
Well, from your global politics perspective, what stood out to you?
In the State of the Union, there's kind of a format, and a lot of times that format is the domestic policies and issues go in the front part of the speech in the first hour,
yep.
The first part, and the foreign policy stuff goes in the back end of the speech or the latter hour. Also, apparently people tune out after the first hour or so, as I understand, sort of ratings and attention spans. And so we did see that format in this case. Obviously that can be changed up when there's, an imminent threat or something to that effect. But we did see the discussion of Ukraine and China and the sort of alliance among European nations in response to Ukraine in the latter part of the speech.
Well, let's touch down here on China, which is in the latter part of the speech, as you mentioned, addressing the alleged Chinese spy balloon, and that was shot down by a U.S. military aircraft over the Atlantic coast last weekend. What did you make of Biden's references to China?
Well, he was putting up a sort of strong front in response to Chinese aggression in this regard. But he also was, explaining that he has had many conversations and sounds like he is in close touch with President Xi, and that, that the United States is prepared to sort of stand tough against China, but also to work collaboratively where their interests align.
And President Biden, he shouted in trying to make this sharp contrast between American democracy and our alliances around the world that President Xi lacks. And here's that moment.
We face serious challenges across the world. But in the past 2 years, democracies have become stronger, not weaker. Autocracies have grown weaker, not stronger. Name me a world leader who changed places with Xi Jinping. Name me one. Name me one.
What do you make of that moment of Biden's worldview?
Well, we have seen democracy under threat in a lot of different countries, including the United States, as a form of government. And he is trying to draw the contrast between a lot of the Western alliance, and Western not necessarily just in place, but in terms of disposition, and China. And so he's, again, this is the last part of the speech. This is the really the back end of the speech here. And so he was getting into the fighting Biden that we had also seen in the earlier part of the speech on domestic issues with his compatriots across the aisle. And so he's, again, sort of drawing that feistiness in his position with regard to Xi.
Let's turn to Ukraine here for a moment. Biden said America will provide Ukrainian soldiers more tanks to aid in the fight that is now going on 1 year of this invasion. How did he discuss our involvement in the war?
Well, he drew this. I thought that this was a clear discussion of not only sort of Putin as someone who has attacked inappropriately and ruthlessly, and Ukrainians who have responded, and also how the European countries and Western countries have come together in a united front against this invasion of Ukraine, and that the United States and Biden as president have also been the leaders of that. He made that pretty clear in his discussion of Ukraine. He also, of course, singled out the ambassador from Ukraine in the audience. And you could also see on a number of members and senators, their lapel pins or pins on their clothing that were Ukrainian flags or indications of support for Ukraine.
Biden called Putin's decision to invade Ukraine a year ago a test for the ages. And I want you to kind of unpack those words. Would you characterize it that way, a test for the ages?
Well, it is the invasion of a sovereign country by another sovereign country, which generally speaking, we see as what we would characterize as a war. Somebody or some country trying to take over another country. And we've seen that in, you know, our world wars. And so this is, in a certain sense, a question of whether or not the sovereign integrity of one nation, in this case, Ukraine, is something that can stand up against the attack from another country, in this case, Russia. And that is a sort of historical, world historical event in a certain sense.
Talking about the State of the Union with Lily Gorin, political science and global studies professor at Carroll University. You can join in with your reaction, your questions about the State of the Union, 800-642-1234. Lily, the Biden administration says it plans to let the national COVID public health emergency expire in May, and the World Health Organization says the virus has killed nearly 7 million people globally. What did Biden have to say about COVID? How did he connect with Americans on the pandemic?
Well, he talked about, you know, some of the problems that we all experienced during the pandemic, and that, you know, it closed down the country, it closed down schools and so forth. And he also, you know, and this is very, very Joe Biden, as a politician and as a person, he presented empathetically the loss of 1 million Americans. And he talked about the fact that, you know, there were empty chairs at the dinner table from the people that we have lost, and other, you know, sort of small ways that we see the loss in our own lives. So as to make it not just this like massive global pandemic, but also the individual experience that people had in losing loved ones to COVID. And so I think in that regard, you know, it was like talking about COVID and talking about the change in policy and so forth, but also talking about how individuals had experienced it.
Is the State of the Union address relevant or anymore, or is it disconnected from the realities of life here in Wisconsin and America?
I don't know that it's disconnected from the realities of life in the United States or in Wisconsin. You know, again, the State of the Union address is a construction that for about 100 years was just written down and delivered to Congress. It's required by the Constitution that the president update Congress on the State of the Union. And it says from time to time. That's what the Constitution says. And Washington went to the to Congress and sort of delivered the State of the Union address. And Adams did the same thing. And then when Jefferson became president, he thought that such a sort of move was very monarchical. And so he stopped that tradition, which again had hardly taken root because the nation was young, and sort of, you know, wrote it down, mailed it in. And then Woodrow Wilson returned to the sort of public experience of the State of the Union address of the president going to Congress, because as you saw at the beginning of the State of the Union, that the president has to be asked to come to the Congress by the House. And again, because the branches are separate, and to sort of, you know, be welcomed into the House as the president of the United States to deliver this message. And so since Woodrow Wilson, which was, you know, a good 100 years ago, we have seen presidents sort of make use of this as a way of speaking directly to the country, originally on radio and then obviously on television. And so it is an opportunity for presidents to sort of pull together an agenda and articulate that to the American people, as well as to Congress. And so, you know, whether or not all those items, and there are many, many items that were touched upon last night,
that laundry list.
Yeah, laundry list, that is one way of putting it, can become law or regulations or so on, is, you know, remains to be seen. But it is a way for presidents to sort of take their space as a leader of agenda and putting things on the agenda. And oftentimes presidents will often then go out to the, you know, to the public and campaign, if you will, on items that they really want
then
to see.
Then they hit the road Congress. And they go to the Madison area, apparently.
Yep.
Lily, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Lily Gorin is a global studies and political science professor at Carroll University. Earlier, we heard from UW La Crosse political scientist Anthony Chergosky. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a classic bar tradition that takes place all year long.
The Meat Raffle, a beloved game where the prize is a frozen turkey, a box of steaks, or a chain of sausage links. For writer and vegetarian Patty C., winning a package of meat can bring on peak joy at her favorite local taverns.
A vegetarian walks into a bar for the meat raffle and air conditioning. I know it sounds like the start of a bad joke, but I recently visited Heartbreaker's Bar and Grill to try to win packages of frozen meat on a 97-degree June day. My husband, Bruce, calls this stretch of Highway OO near our house the Lake Halley Strip. A little less bling than the one in Vegas, but entertaining in its own way. I've been a vegetarian on and off since high school. For the last 15 years, I've eaten mostly a plant-based diet, but I still enjoy making fall-off-the-bone pork roast, slow-cooked barbecue ribs, or rare steaks and burgers. I'm also an ex-smoker who will light your cigarette. A meat raffle is like every raffle. Buy a ticket and wait for your number to get called. As a Catholic, I've been playing this sort of game since I could hold my own paddle, usually a paint stick with markered on numbers. At each church picnic, I won more cakes or pop bottles than my family could carry. Meat raffles are a long-standing Wisconsin tradition, from small-town VFW halls to big city hipster bars, enjoyed by 90-year-olds to 20-somethings. Turns out, World War II-era meat rationing in Britain prompted the first meat raffles. People pooled their meager protein supply, and some lucky chap won enough for a feast. This concept soon caught on in the United States. Years ago, when Bruce first read Meat Raffle Tonight on a Highway 00 tavern marquee, he thought it was a cool band name. We still laugh about that. Other businesses away from the Strip, like the Eagles Club or Lake Halley Sportsman's Club, hold meat raffles for local charities. The Eagles takes a break June and July. That means for 10 months of the year, a winner could bring home the bacon 3 nights a week, just in Lake Halley alone. Each time you buy a drink at Heartbreakers on Tuesday after 5 p.m., you get a meat raffle ticket. Where else do the odds of winning increase the more you drink? The raffle begins at 6 sharp. The second number called is mine. I whoop my way from our table to the bartender to verify my ticket, and then whoop some more to the spread of frozen meat. It's as if my name's just been called on The Price is Right. Only today, it's not Bob Barker, but the 20 or so other patrons who smile patiently while yet another middle-aged contestant screams. I poke through the prizes, a 2-pack of ring bologna or a whole chicken, a bag of cheese curds or beef sticks, pork tenderloin or a rack of ribs. I settle on a pound of jumbo shrimp. I never won crustaceans before, so of course I hold the frozen bag over my head like a trophy and whoop my way back to our table. We order another round of drinks. Soon my cousin's number is called. We all cheer. She chooses the ribs. Later, Connie teases me, "Think there's a vegetable raffle somewhere?" Bruce says no one would go. I would, of course. And you know, I'd win something.
Patty C. is a writer from Lake Halley, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now, a growing number of the nation's top-ranked law schools are boycotting the annual rankings of the best law schools by U.S. News & World Report. And some elite medical schools are also following suit, deciding not to submit data for the rankings. Call in about U.S. News rankings as a tool and how you view them. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dan Tokaji is a professor and dean of the University of Wisconsin Law School. Dan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So the UW Law School opting out of this year's U.S. News rankings for law schools. Take us into this decision and why you made it.
Sure. Well, we're one of 36 law schools, could be a few more now, but at the time of our decision, 36 law schools that have decided not to participate in this year's U.S. News survey. And the fundamental problem with the U.S. News ranking from our perspective at the University of Wisconsin Law School is that it does not align with our values. At Wisconsin, we're committed to providing a world-class education and doing so affordably so that students aren't saddled with huge debt when they graduate, which would really limit their career choices. That's not, unfortunately, what U.S. News values. Historically, they've put a high priority on how much you spend, and median LSAT and GPA, these are useful tools, but to incentivize schools to focus on them, particularly when they award scholarship money, we think is unhealthy for legal education as a whole. So stepping away from the U.S. News survey is a way for us at Wisconsin to focus on what's really most important to us, that is providing a first-rate education at an affordable price.
So, you know, they have a right to rank schools. You have a right not to participate. So what does that mean for these rankings? Because they have such an outside influence, you know, outsized influence on people as they look at the integrity of these schools.
That's right. The U.S. News ranking in particular, and that's especially true for law schools, really does have outsized influence. And look, I think the most healthy thing to come away from this, from all the law schools that have now bailed out of the U.S. News survey, is that it will not eliminate but weaken the force that this U.S. News ranking has in law school, law students or prospective law students who are trying to decide what's the best fit for them. And I think the big message is that the U.S. News ranking is not a very reliable source of information So much of it is based on median, LSAT, and GPA, as well as peer and lawyer judge reputation surveys that go out to lawyers and judges, a scattered few throughout the country, most of whom really don't know very much about the law schools that they're ranking. From our perspective, it would really be best to focus on affordability, on what kind of educational opportunities are you really offering to your students. For example, at Wisconsin, we offer fantastic experiential learning opportunities for students to represent real live clients in real cases. And that's not something that's taken into consideration in the rankings. And you know, we also want to make sure that our law school, especially as the state's flagship public law school, remains open to everyone, and that we're providing a pathway to the legal profession to people from all sorts of backgrounds, not just for more affluent students. It's really important for us to provide access to people from rural and urban areas, regardless of how wealthy their family is. And that's not really something that's valued by the U.S. News ranking either.
What do you think of the U.S. News ranking response in response to this, to these boycotts and the backlash? I mean, they've changed, revamped their criteria. They're looking at more, putting more weight on lower wage public service jobs, no longer considering indicators of like student debt in the rankings. What would lure you back?
Yeah, I think that they're not really doing a whole lot on the public service, public interest front, which is really important to us. At Wisconsin, about 43% of our graduating class goes into governmental jobs or jobs in the nonprofit sector. And the changes they made really don't take that into consideration at all. They made one change that I think is favorable, so I want to give them some credit for that, which is to eliminate a really pernicious aspect of the ranking, expenditures per student, basically how much money you're spending. Well, where does that money come from? For the most part, it comes from students in the form of higher tuition. So that was really unfortunate, was a factor in driving tuitions up. Unfortunately, they've gotten rid of something that we think was really constructive, and that is considering law students' debt upon graduation. This is a metric in which Wisconsin does especially well. Our average debt is $48,000, which may sound like a lot, but at a lot of other law schools, it's well over $100,000, which really limits career choices. Unfortunately, U.S. News has taken that debt metric out entirely of this year's ranking, and that was certainly a contributing factor to our decision to withdraw.
Do you foresee a future where you would participate in these rankings?
I think we would certainly be open to that possibility if U.S. News were willing to make some changes that better aligned with our values, and in particular that took into consideration the necessity of our providing a pathway into the legal profession for people of all backgrounds and not just the most wealthy and affluent. That's really important to us at Wisconsin, and it's essential to our mission as a public university. So if U.S. News were to put more value on access and affordability, I think that's something that would certainly be a consideration in deciding whether to opt back into the U.S. News survey at some point in the future.
Dan Tokaji with us, Dean of the UW Law School, as we look at the challenges of how to prepare students for a career in law, what the rankings mean. Colin, with your questions, your experiences about the legal profession, your law degree, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the headwinds in preparing law school students for the workforce, especially efforts to advance more equitable outcomes. And ways to promote diversity throughout the profession. Call in with your story, your questions about a career in law, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dan Tokaji is Dean of the UW Law School, stays with us. Dan, the State Bar of Wisconsin calling the shortage of public defenders and prosecutors statewide a constitutional crisis, with UW, Madison, and Marquette offering the state's only law schools. How is your law school preparing students to graduate into this strained workforce?
Well, it is a problem that prosecutors as well as public defenders are paid so little. There is a significant problem throughout the country, but it's especially bad in Wisconsin with finding people to fill these really important jobs. We have an important role to play in preparing students to pursue all sorts of careers, whether it's in business or law firms or the nonprofit sector, as well as in the public sector. And that certainly includes people who are working in the criminal justice system as prosecutors or defense attorneys. It's really hard work, but it's essential work. As a law school, what we at University of Wisconsin have really tried to do is to keep our levels of tuition and most importantly, student debt at manageable levels so that our students are able to pursue whatever career path they choose. And they don't necessarily have to choose the place that's paying them or offering to pay them top dollar. And so, you know, that's what I think we can do as a law school to try to make careers in public interest and public service.
And I want to
prosecutors. Go ahead.
I want to jump in here because when you cited the statistic of 43% of UW law school grads last year going into public service or public interest jobs last year, is that enough? Are you satisfied with that outcome, with that percentage?
You know, I guess I would say this. I am proud of that percentage that we have so many of our students who choose to pursue paths in public service and public interest. One of the things that we put in our most recent strategic plan that we adopted a couple of years ago is that we want our graduates at University of Wisconsin Law School to, of course, be free to pursue whatever career path they choose, but especially to be prepared not only to be great lawyers, but change agents, people who are working to advance justice. So, you know, I want to emphasize that the career path that students choose is ultimately up to them. We want to prepare them for all sorts of different careers. But yeah, I'm very proud of the fact that so many of our students go into public interest and public service work.
You mentioned pay and the issues there. Starting pay for Wisconsin's assistant DAs is less than $57,000 a year. We know the debt you've talked about of law school grads, less in Wisconsin, more in other law schools, perhaps around the country. Yeah. What is your message to state lawmakers as they try to address the shortage of attorneys in Wisconsin?
Well, I want to be very careful in my capacity as dean of the law school not to get involved in particular fights over particular pieces of legislation. But it is really important that people in these vital jobs as prosecutors, as well as public defenders, be paid a decent wage that will allow them to raise a family, have a home for themselves, be able to save money to send their children to college, all the things that all of us, I think, would like to do. And it's really tough to do that for this really important work at the relatively low rates that people are paid to serve as prosecutors and public defenders, especially here in Wisconsin.
What is a fair wage? What is a decent wage?
I'm going to leave that to policymakers as well as, you know, the state bar and those groups that are advocating on behalf of state prosecutors and defenders to decide what exactly is an appropriate rate. That's not really my call to make, but I do think something that's more than what they're being paid right now. And what I can say from our perspective is it can be tough to take these jobs and be able to pay back your educational loans at the low rates that they're paying right now.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, many moons ago, decades ago, my roommate was a Philadelphia public defender and worked night and day, like literally around the clock for their clients in multiple languages and just yeoman's work. But the sentiment there, at least in Philly, was you did your time as a public defender and you got your pick of private law firms. I mean, you could really take that anywhere. Is that sentiment still true?
I certainly think there's some truth to it. I mean, my perspective is, and I've had a lot of students who've gone to work for prosecutor's offices or public defender offices over the 20 years now that I've been in law school teaching. Some of them stay in those jobs for their entire careers. Some of them move on, but I really don't think that there's any way for someone who's interested in becoming a trial lawyer. You know, that's what I think the general public thinks when they think of lawyers. Lawyers do all sorts of different work. But what most people probably envision is someone standing up in court, cross-examining witnesses, and making opening and closing statements before judge and jury.
What we see on TV.
If you want to do that kind of work, I don't think there's any better place to do it than a prosecutor's or public defender's office.
Talking with Dan Tokaji, professor of law and dean of UW-Madison's Law School. You can join in along the way, 800-642-1234. I want to just ask you about not taking the bar. You've worried that the American Bar Association's push to eliminate the law school admissions test would harm diversity in admissions, and supporters of the change say it would give law schools more flexibility in their admissions. What is your response to that?
Yeah, I think that's fool's gold. And, you know, the AB House of Delegates, by a voice vote earlier this week, voted not to change that ABA standard. Look, I pointed out earlier that it is unhealthy to focus overly much on mean or median LSATs or GPAs in law schools making decisions, as the US News ranking incentivizes law schools to do. But I do think that these are really valuable tools, and I'm quite worried about a potential race to the bottom if this ABA standard is eliminated, that there's going to be a strong incentive, because all law schools want to increase their applications, to simply eliminate the LSAT or any other standardized test as a requirement. And what I'm worried about in particular is that's ultimately going to hurt our diversity, including not only racial diversity, but socioeconomic background, because there are a lot of people who don't have a great GPA, but actually have the capacity to succeed and thrive as lawyers. And the LSAT can be a very useful tool in identifying those students and admitting them to law school. You know, I mean, certainly there are racial and other disparities in the LSAT and other standardized tests, but we'd be naive to think those disparities don't also exist in GPA and the other criteria that might replace the LSAT if it's eliminated.
Dan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Dan Tokaji is a professor and dean of the UW Law School. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.